This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from my home studio, while my producer Lee Delapina is in our main studio in the heart of the Bluegrass in Lexington, Kentucky. As always, you are listening live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and you're doing that on our website at horseracingradio.net. Happy to have you along for the next hour. Tonight's guest, this is really interesting. Today's guest, he's worked alongside his dad, helping to build one of the most successful stables in our sport today. Now, among their notable winners are names like Geoponte and Tonalist. And this past Friday, the operation reached yet another milestone with a 2,000th victory to their credit when Gufo, a three-year-old colt, won an allowance race at Gulfstream Park. And pretty cool stuff, as my guest today has played a critical role in all that success. And as you'll hear, the 28-year-old may be the most well-traveled and well-rounded assistant trainer in the game today. Please join me in welcoming Miguel Clement, who is the assistant trainer to his father, Christophe, and he's with me tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Miguel, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Boy, a lot of things happening. Yeah, I guess we should probably start at the beginning, by the way, and talk about you and your sister, Charlotte, who pretty much grew up around the backside, even though your dad said that he did everything he could to expose you to other things than racing. That didn't really work out, did it?
Well, it definitely didn't work out for me, and I'm not sure about my sister, to be honest. She's still in school at the moment as we speak, but unfortunately, it's a bit like a drug. You just can't stop, so racing was like that for me.
Yeah, tell me about growing up around the racetrack. What was that like?
Well, for us, it was unique. Cause, you know, my father's based in Florida and New York, so we used to move, you know, between the three operations, between Belmont, Saratoga, and our Payson Park, which is our Florida operation. So it was a bit unique in the sense that I did schools, and my schools were basically tailored to the locations we were at. So I did some locations several times in a year, and it was great for us. That's all I knew. So it was very normal for me in that sense. It was probably abnormal for most of my other peers and classmates, but I loved it as a kid. Racing was the best for me, and nothing beat going to the races on the weekends, and I loved being immersed in it.
Yeah, it's a lot like a military family where they're moving around the country and around the world, quite frankly, and the kids have to adapt. Talk about some of the challenges that were presented as a child when you were moving from location to location.
Well, to be honest, my mother was very supportive and very involved in us academically. So she took a lot of the load in that sense because, you know, I would start the year in New York, then do another school in Florida, and then finish the year back in the same school in New York. So there's some subjects I may have done it twice over in my, you know, education process, and there are other subjects that I might have completely missed. So my mom made sure, for instance, that whenever another school would move to another fort or chapter of material that we never covered, she would make sure she would bridge that gap. So it was not the most straightforward education process, you could say, but I don't think you would say it hindered either of us, between my sister and I. But to be honest, it's racing always came first in our households, and it's just a sacrifice you had to do if you loved the game, which we all did.
I'm the only one in my family to be involved in racing on any level at all. I think it's so cool that you were raised in a family that was so dedicated to our sport that we all love. So what was that like, Miguel, being raised in a racing family?
You know, it's simple. The worst consequence my mom could give me when I was a kid growing up was I would be grounded from going racing on the weekends. So that was very much the ultimate punishment, and that would create the biggest tantrum and the biggest unhappiness for me when I was a kid. And we quickly very realized what it takes, for instance, to have a successful company and what it takes in terms of your private life and your work life, the sacrifice you must do in order to compete at the level you want to compete at, to be honest.
And you're kind of carrying on a family tradition here. It's not just about your father, but this goes all the way back to your grandfather and your uncle who is involved. Tell me about your family tree.
Yes, my grandfather was a very good trainer in France. He passed away quite young, unfortunately. And then as a result, my uncle and my father both started training at the same time, more or less. My uncle started training open shop in France. He actually won the Arc, which is like the biggest race to win in Europe, his very first year of training. And I think that had a lot to do with my father going to another location. So my father decided to open up shop here in the States. He was actually an assistant at the time in England. And they still speak frequently. They speak to each other all the time. And it's great. You have my uncle in France. You have my father here in the States. And it's fantastic. You know, you can bounce back ideas, different training philosophies, people, feeds, regimes. I mean, you can name the things they could think and you could discuss with someone else who's training at a high level as well in another, you know, continent. It's great. It's great. It's great. As well as the horses. You can notice my dad has a lot of French purchases, and my uncle plays a big role in that. So it's definitely a great edge. It's a great benefit, and it's a great relationship to have.
How old were you when your Uncle Nicholas won the Arc, and do you remember much about that day?
No, unfortunately, I don't think I was born. He won in the 90s. I was born in 91, so I missed it. He won it with Silmarez.
Okay. Have you gone back and watched the replays of that race? Are they available even to watch?
Yeah. They're available, not quite the greatest quality. They're on YouTube, as you can imagine. And I follow my uncle's runners closely. I know his stable quite well, and he has a lot of success back in France. He trains in Chantilly, which is gorgeous. If anyone's never been there, they should definitely see it once. And I've actually worked for him several times. And you learn a lot. When traveling, you learn a lot, believe me.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that traveling that you've done. I mentioned at the top of the show, maybe the most well-traveled and well-rounded assistant that we have in the sport today, and I think people will realize that when we get into that conversation. But visiting with Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Miguel, what's it like working with your dad?
It's great. And as he would say, every day is a holiday when you get to work with him.
do you agree?
Yeah, of course. It's great. It takes a bit of an impact in the sense that if you have a bad day, more than likely he would have a bad day. So I suppose for the family, you know, you have it twice as good or twice as bad. But when you have the same passion and the same ambition and the same dream or the same aspiration, I suppose it's very much a gift to share it with a family member. And I'm very privileged to have that relationship with my dad. And we work well together, which may not always be the same case for, you know, other father-son relationships. But I'm very close to him, so I'm very fortunate to have it. And believe me, I'm his biggest supporter, and hopefully the same the other way around. But it's fantastic. And it was a big deal. I was very happy for the boss, for instance, the other day, my dad, to get his 2000th winner, and for the entire stables, because it was very meaningful for him. He did it, you know, without having ever a medication suspension or a violation to his name. And it's a big feat for him, so I was very happy for him.
Yeah, special day. You know, people, they don't realize, Miguel, if they're outside of the sport, how difficult it is, number one, just to get a horse to the races. And then to win a race, any race, is so difficult to do. To win 2,000, put that in perspective, Miguel. How incredible is that accomplishment?
It's a lot of work. To do 2,000 winners, any operation will tell you it's a big milestone. It takes a lot of work. And believe me, the amount of things that can go wrong, you'd be amazed as to the amount of things that can go wrong. So to get to 2,000 winners, it's a great accomplishment, and I was very proud of my dad for that. So hopefully we still have many more to come, don't get me wrong, but it was a big feat.
How'd you guys celebrate that night?
To be honest, we didn't celebrate much. The following day was the Florida Derby day, which we had two big runners that day, so we're a bit on the edge about that for the next day. That's the great thing about our sport. When you have a great day or an awful day, it's back to the drawing boards no matter what, because the next day you got to keep competing. You can never rest on your laurels, and you have to think about tomorrow and the next day and the future. And you always have to think about the future. You always have to keep thinking about what can you do to improve your stock of horses, your staff, what can you do to improve yourself, your organization. And you have to always keep your eye on the next objective. So, yeah.
What kind of teacher is your dad?
Oh, he's very hands-on himself. He's very fair, disciplined, and those would be the best words, I think, to describe my dad, to be honest.
How about his training style? How would you describe his style of training?
It's very much European approach, but it changes. He would tell you, he's a firm believer that when you train, you always have to adapt your training. You never stay in a certain school of thought or train a certain type of way, because as time goes on, you'll be pressured either by outside factors. Horses change, race courses, the distance, the races, or even, you know, the outside factors, for instance, like labor. You have to alter your training in such a way to make sure you could adapt. So in order to be successful, you always have to adapt. So I think you should always keep that in the back of your mind. But if I had to describe him one way, I would say it's very European-like. After spending a lot of time working abroad, it would probably most resemble that of a European trainer. He likes to take his time with every set. He's very hands-on. He loves to go for long walks before and after training. More time spent with the horses, the better it is for him. And that would be more or less his philosophy. He believes he'd rather have fewer horses in training than probably a lot of people we compete with on a day-in, day-out basis. But as a result, we can compete with them because we spend more time and we emphasize the quality. Quality of horses, quality of work. And the more time you spend with the horses, the less mistakes you make.
Yeah, you mentioned the long walks and the European style of training. What are the benefits, Miguel, of the benefits to the horse of training horses in that fashion?
Well, hopefully when you spend more time with them, they reward you more in the sense that they're more calm, they're more trusting of the people that work with them. They're less on the edge. They're more settled for training before and after. Hopefully you have less tie-ups. You have more horses that are more straightforward to train, less anxious. And if everything goes according to plan, it should hopefully reflect that on race day.
If I asked your dad what kind of trainer is Miguel, what do you think he'd say? How would he describe you as a trainer?
I don't know. You should ask him, but hopefully he'll say someone is good.
You know, he was quoted in an article, I believe it was in the TDN, actually. He said, "It's fun when your son can bring new things to the table, things that he even wasn't exposed to." So what types of new things have you been able to introduce him to?
Listen, I was very fortunate. I did the Darley Flank Start. So after graduating Duke, I did the Darley Flank Start. So I worked 2 years on the Darley Flank Start. Now it's called the Godolphin Flank Start, but when I did, it was called the Darley Flank Start. And then after that, I was fortunate enough to spend more time with Mike Tocock in South Africa. And then I spent, I believe, 2 seasons as a pupil assistant to Hugo Palmer, who's a trainer back in England, and who had a great year then. And it was great. You see many new things, and you learn a lot. So in terms of new ideas or philosophies you could bring back to the stable when I came back to the States, my dad and I, we spoke every day, even when I was abroad. But in terms of styles of training or medication, for instance, or concepts or, you know, philosophies, or the way they break horses abroad or racing, as well as the bloodstocks or how other successful trainers maintain, you know, a dynasty in foreign, you know, abroad, it's there's many things you can learn. You can never stop learning in our game, which is great. And it's important to keep in mind that there is no correct way, in the sense that what works for you may not work for someone else. And as long as if it works for you, just keep doing the same, you know, system, because if it works for you, it's something's clearly, you know, successful, and you should keep pursuing it. So in that sense, there's lots of different approaches that we adapted a little bit and we tweak. And the great thing with my dad is we keep changing, we keep evolving, and you know, there's never a certain set or way of principle. If you ask my dad how he trains now compared to 28 years ago when he first started, I'm sure it's different, and it keeps changing. You know, even daily, there's different ideas or concepts you should always discover, think about, and push yourself to embrace new challenges and ideas.
Talking with Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Miguel, you mentioned graduating from Duke University in North Carolina. You majored in economics there. Was there a time when you said, you know what, maybe I'll try to do something outside of horse racing?
No, my parents forced me to get out of racing as much as they can, and it didn't quite work out for them, but they tried. Give them credit because they did try. And I always knew I was going to come back to horses. It's just great to have, you know, an economics degree in case. It's, I don't know, it's always great to have. But for me, it was always horses. I'm not very popular with the UK fans, as you can imagine, having a Duke's economics, especially right now when there's no sports watching on TV and all you see is Christian Laettner on the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary. Nevertheless, that was a great time. And then after Duke, as I mentioned, I went straight to the Darley Flying Starts, and then I worked abroad a bit, and I came back home.
When you come to Keeneland to run horses here, do you tend to wear a little more Duke hats or Duke shirts or sweatshirts when you come here?
I tend to be more discreet about it in Kentucky. It doesn't always work out for me, however.
You mentioned the Darley Flying Start program, and that happened after you graduated college in 2013. Why did you go into Darley Flying Start?
I went to Darley Flying Start because I wanted to learn more. I always wanted to travel. I always wanted to learn from people abroad. I spent a bit of time working for my uncle abroad, but I wanted to spend a significant portion of time. And the more you see in our profession, the more you learn. There's no set of school, for instance, to become a trainer. There's no sort of program. It's not like, for instance, becoming a carpenter or even a blacksmith or any sort of other profession. You kind of learn as you see more and you do it yourself and you figure it out. And as a result, I thought the more I can see, the more I can learn, the more I can see from the best people around the world, that's the best way you can have an education. And therefore, that's why I thought the Darley Flying Start made the logical sense right after completing university.
Did you get to see everything you wanted to see?
I was fortunate enough to work in Australia, for instance, for, like Chris Waller. So yeah. Chris Waller in Australia was like the leading trainer in Australia. That was a great experience. I only spent a month there. I would love to spend a lot more time with him, but that was fantastic. In Dubai, I worked a little bit for Mike Lecoq. That was fantastic. Because after the program, I decided to spend some more time and get very close to his son Matthew and Mike back in South Africa. And then my English placement, I did it with Hugo Palmer, which is terrific. Then I spent the 2 seasons with him afterwards. And that was a great, you know, great introduction to the Hugo Palmer outfits. And then you have a placement also in the States. I did mine with West Point, which is great because, you know, West Point's a big part of the stables now, especially with our probably arguably our best 3-year-old in training. So that was a great introduction to West Point.
Yeah, did you get to see everything you were hoping you would get to see and experience with Flying Start, or are there still a couple of things that you have on your bucket list you would like to do, maybe internationally?
Of course, you want to see as much as you can, and no, if I have a bucket list, there's millions of things I still want to learn and see more. You'd love to spend more time in every country you work in and see how they do it from the breaking process, the breeding, the foaling, the entire racing. You would love to do everything more, but at some point or another, after being abroad for 4 years, I said it's time to come back home to the States, back to the stable where I always wanted to work with my dad. But if time was, you know, limitless, of course, I would spend a lot more time abroad and try to learn even more than I did.
You mentioned the name Chris Waller, leading trainer in Australia, and you talked about how great it was to spend time with him. There are people listening that have no idea who Chris Waller is. So tell us a little bit about him and why he's so successful and things you learned from him.
He would be best known for Americans, perhaps, for the trainer of Winx, you would say. But he himself, yep, he has unbelievable seasons in terms of prize money, in terms of reputation and win streak. He has accomplished a tremendous amount in Australia. I was fascinated with the Australian approach. They give trial races and as well as the races. So, for instance, they use races sometimes as a building block for a particular key race. So let's say, for instance, you have a big race that you really want to win with a good horse, and it was like 2 months from now, they would have a trial race or two, and then they would have preparation races. They would run horses a lot more frequently than we do, but they would sometimes run horses over the wrong trips and distances just in order to get them ready for the big day. So races would actually serve as a prep for the big race, and the outcome of the prep races meant basically nothing to them, which was fascinating. So you would have grade one horses who were mile-and-a-half horses running over 7 furlong races, you know, 2-3 weeks out before a big race, getting beat in the preps, for instance, like in the listed race, stakes race, and you know, American owners, you'd be devastated. And over there, they just embraced it because they knew that it was a good preparation for the big race in 2 or 3 weeks, which would be like a mile and a half. And they'd, you know, they'd be a lot less worried about getting a horse beat. You know, the record did not mean so much for them, a horse's record. They would run horses a lot more frequently than us. And they loved to spell horses, which every season they would give at least one or two spells, which were big breaks to horses. They loved it. It's something that now we have year-round racing. We, as in my father, very much still does. A lot of our better horses over the winter get a proper break at Payson Park. They get some paddocks and turnouts, and they get out of training. But I think a lot of people in the States don't give them enough of a break. And by doing so, it keeps them mentally and physically fresh, and hopefully that, you know, they last longer. So I was very proud of that. I was very very appreciative that, in fact, the entire Australian racing culture embraced spelling horses. And even though they can have year-round racing like we do in the States, they very much had seasons. So they gave the horses a break, even if, you know, the climate-wise, they were able to race year-round like we do. They still had very much seasons, and it was nice and neat to see. Plus, they love racing down there.
What does it mean to buy horses on spec, Miguel?
Buy horses on spec. So I started doing a lot of my dad's bloodstock work, and too many times we missed horses either privately in Europe because finding the money sometimes is the, you know, toughest phrase when buying a horse, and agreeing on the small details. So if we found a horse on partnership that we liked, we tell our owners about it, and sometimes, you know, if we had different owners, depending on, there's certain criteria they would like to have, i.e., for instance, silks or naming, or even, for instance, their game plan or how much they're willing to spend. So instead of dealing with all the small details before a public sale or even privately, we tend to buy on spec. So at no markups, we sometimes sell it back to our clients, but just we love to do it in the fact that we could be the quickest ones to make an offer on a horse that we liked, that we thought was very impressive, if a horse is running. We don't have to worry about finding the money. We deal with that afterwards, and we just make an offer. Or even at public sales, we don't worry about, you know, agreeing that all partners before the sales have to agree on a certain percentage or a certain maximum amount. We wouldn't want one partner to be left out of it, and therefore, if a horse has cost a bit more than previously, do we need to ask all three partners permission or however many partners we had? That was a lot more efficient for him just to deal with like almost like a blank checkbook. So he loves just to buy, pick out the ones he likes, and he buys it, and then it's my job afterwards to find the money. But that's basically buy on spec, because most of the times when we purchase our horses, he actually does it without having a buyer in mind, and then it's my job to figure it out afterwards, which is rather stressful at times, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be a stressful situation. Have you ever had a situation where you couldn't come up with the money?
No, because fortunately my dad has very good taste, so whenever he likes one a lot and he buys it, our owners tend to follow suit, so it's it works out well for us.
Yeah, and of course I bring that up because that was something, if I'm not mistaken, that was something you were introduced to, that concept of buying horses on spec as you were traveling the world. Is that right?
Correct. Because yeah. When you compete against, you know, a European market, you're not the only Americans, A, purchasing the horse, but B, you also have lots of other nationalities. So especially in Europe, the Australians are hunting for the same horses. The Hong Kong market is also pursuing the horses privately. You also have other Americans, as well as other Europeans itself. So if a horse had really impressed us and I was able to have some more information than others, either via my uncle or whichever bloodstock agents we use abroad, hopefully we may be able to beat them whenever you make a deal, not by the amount of money, but perhaps by the speed at which you can make an offer. So in order to do that, sometimes you just have to buy them on spec. You know, you make an offer on spec and you find the client afterwards.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Talking with Miguel Clement on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. Miguel, we have about 3 or 4 minutes before we have to get to our break at the bottom of the hour. But you talked about Chris Waller and the way things are done in Australia. A name that Americans are very familiar with is South African conditioner Mike de Kock, and you talked about being around his operation. Talk a little bit about Mike and the way he approaches the game.
I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time with Mike and his son Matthew de Kock. I thoroughly loved it all, both in Dubai as well as South Africa. He really pushed me in the sense that makes you think unconventionally. I was impressed. We actually adopted a lot of similar training feats and patterns as he would. At the moment, all our horses at Payson, unless they're in either a week or two away from running or currently racing, they're trained in the sense that they're barefoot. At Payson, we get away with it because there is no concrete. Mike Tokalk, all of his horses are barefoot. They'd put shoes the day of the race and remove it back in Dubai, and same in South Africa. They're trained barefoot, and I think the overwhelming majority of horses can handle it, and it actually creates a healthier, bigger foot. In New York, unfortunately, we have to train them with shoes because, you know, on the backside, there's a lot of concrete roads where the horses have to walk to and from the track, and it's just not feasible. However, in Florida, we're able to replicate it, and I'm a big fan of it. So in that sense, that was one thing that I've really admired from the Dukak. Training with treadmills, I would love to have a treadmill at Payson. I keep urging my father to make the big sacrifice and make the big purchase for having a treadmill in Florida. And I'm working on it. I'm not sure if I'm going to get there or not anytime soon, but I'm working on it. But it was great to see. He trained a lot on the treadmill. You're able to control your, you know, your speed. You're able to control your, you know, daily exercise. And the amount of times you could use a treadmill, if you have a bad track, for instance, in my case, I was thinking, or horses with a bad mouth or have an abscess somewhere around their back and you don't want to put the stress of a wide rider on their back, or you want to control the exercise they're doing. I thought that's just other tools you can use, which we did in Dubai in South Africa, that you are just not able to do here at the moment in the States. But fortunately for us, we're based year-round in the same location, which is Payson Park, so we don't move that much. We come back to the same three locations every year. So I always thought maybe we should make the investment into a treadmill because they are expensive and they're rather large. But if you keep it stationary, you know, a lot of people and a lot of trainers in Europe are starting to do it now, you know, adopt treadmills. So I was just thinking that would be a great tool to have perhaps one day.
Yeah, people may not realize that your dad spent time working with Shug McGahey before he went out on his own, and Shug is often described as being old school. Is it possible, from what you just said, is it possible that your dad is maybe even more old school than Shug?
No, he welcomes new ideas. He may not always agree with it, but he always welcomes them, to be honest, because it makes you think twice. And we don't always agree, but our objective is always the same. So how we get there, he's very much the boss, and it's his way, but, you know, we're able to tweak a lot. And it makes you think twice, you know. Sometimes, like I mentioned earlier, there's no right way. If it works for you, then keep the system you have, because if it works and it's successful, that means you're doing something right. So some trainers, for instance, when I worked in Australia or Dubai, only train via treadmills or swimming horses. Some only train them on the track. It varies per operation, but it's just, you know, a great tool to have, in my opinion. So.
Yeah, well, they've done a lot of things right over the years, and as you heard my special guest Miguel Clement say, that 2,000th victory last week at Gulfstream Park meant an awful lot to him, to his dad, and the entire team. I'm going to continue this visit with Miguel in the second half of the program right after this short break. Stay with me. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're gonna have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
time-tested Broken Vow continues to deliver quality black-type stakes horses at a 15% clip. The top son of Unbridled has sired over 150 black-type horses, 80 black-type winners, and over $75 million in earnings. Among the 12 black-type horses sired by Broken Vow in 2019 was dual Canadian Classic winner Tone Broke, winner of classic races on dirt and turf. Also the sire of Imprimis, the Speedy Keeneland graded stakes winner of over $440,000. Give your mare a great start with a proven sire, Broken Vow, standing at Pin Oak Stud.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
California Chrome is coming down the center of the racetrack, but it's Tonalist with the narrow lead. California Chrome is there, wicked strong, late bit on the far outside. Commissioner hanging tough down toward the rail. Time ticking away in the Triple Crown. Commissioner down inside. Tonalist between horses. California Chrome laboring late. Here's the wire, and it's a photo finish that goes to Tonalist. Tonalist does it. Commissioner was second. Medal count was third.
Tom Durkin with the call of that 2014 running of the Test of the Champion, the Belmont Stakes. It was won by Tonalist for trainer Christophe Clement, and his son, Miguel, his longtime assistant, is with me here on the program tonight. Hope you enjoyed the first half of the program. Looking forward to this visit in the second half of the show as well. If you missed any portion of the show, real simple. All you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this program and all of our shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts, another way you can access the shows. And don't forget to follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. We'd love to hear your thoughts and comments about this show and all of our shows, and you can email the program, mike@horseracingradio.net. Miguel, you hear that call, Tonalist winning the Belmont Stakes in 2014. When you hear that and you listen back to it here on the radio, what are some of the things that immediately come to mind?
It was, without a doubt, the best racing day of my lifetime. It was fantastic. It was a classic race, as you know. It probably broke a little bit our mold of only being a turf training outfit. I was very worried for my dad and the whole stables. You know, he had staff, the key guys have been there for years and years with my dad. You know, Christophe Loriot's been there from the very beginning, as well as many of our key foremen. And it was great. It was a great win. To be honest, we didn't actually quite know we won the race, first off, because we were a bit behind the finishing line. And it was so loud because it was the year of California Chrome. I believe there was a huge crowd that day. And from our angle, we thought we just missed. It looked like Joel just got there just too late, and that commissioner beat us on the rail. So to be completely honest, my dad might have said a few things, you know, right during the, you know, right after the race, thinking we got, you know, just missed by a stride. And of course, no one ever heard that or even knew that, because I think the whole press was focused on California Chrome and then Steve Coburn's remarks after the race. So I'm a bit lucky in that regard. But it was a terrific day. He was a great horse. You know, he won four grade ones from mile to mile and a half. And he never missed a beat, that horse. So no, it was a great, great special day.
When you're coming into a Belmont Stakes like that, you're the underdog. There's a horse going for a Triple Crown. What's the feeling like in the approach on your end?
No. He was not the underdog. I mean, people say he might have been the underdog, but if you knew the horse, you won very impressively the Peter Pan. The only time, you know, he won his maiden incredibly impressively at Gulfstream. They came back, he ran second in allowance at Gulfstream, and we were devastated. In that race, it turned out to be Constitution won the race. Tonalist ran second, and fourth was Wicked Strong. I mean, who would have guessed that the first, second, and fourth place finishers were those three horses in an allowance at Gulfstream? So I think we might have just picked the hardest, you know, allowance that ever took place at Gulfstream that day. Then he came back. He was supposed to run in the wood, but had a bit of a hiccup. And then he came back in the Peter Pan instead, which was annoying because we missed the Kentucky Derby. But he romped in the Peter Pan, and from that point onwards, he always showed he was a, you know, different class. He's never missed a beat, and he ran as a three-year-old and four-year-old, never ducked anybody, and ran in all the biggest races year-round. So that was great.
I love the way.
But before the race, no, we thought he was going to run big. Was he going to get up or not? I couldn't tell you honestly, but we were sure he was going to at least run big.
You know, I love the way you just defended your player, too, when I said that about being the underdog coming into that race, because I've always said, if you're a trainer, you better defend your player, right? If your horse is going into a big race, you better have the confidence to come out and back that horse and back that ownership group that you're training for.
Yeah, no, I agree. Listen, he was, it's all about defending yourself, I suppose. I suppose Toneless, everyone called him a Belmont horse. I was happy he won, you know. Everyone forgets he broke his maiden very impressive at Gulfstream, and he also won, I think at the time it's called the Cigar Mile or the New York Mile, which is at Aqueduct. You know, he was just pigeonholed maybe as a Belmont specialist, but he won grade ones from a mile to a mile and a half, and he won big races, you know, at many different racetracks. And I suppose it's no different than, for instance, my dad, who's probably pigeonholed or labeled as a turf trainer. I suppose it's great that you're labeled as something good, but I think our stats would kind of defend that. He's, you know, very capable of winning races on turf or dirt or polytrack from two-year-olds all the way to, you know, nine-year-olds. That's pure sensation as a nine-year-old at the moment. From 5 furlongs on grass to a mile and a half on dirt, it's, I think the stats are okay, to be honest.
Yeah, has that always been something that's kind of been a bit of a sticking point or a motivating point for your dad, as people have, I think, looked at him as being a turf trainer because he's had so much success with horses on the grass?
It's very much because of the horses were sent. You know, at first my dad was sent many, many European horses. And as a result, you know, they have affinity for the turf. So as a result, he had success on the grass, and then he got the label. But it doesn't really, you know, affect us. It's just the truth that our stock is predominantly turf, and we're trying to purchase as many dirt horses and get away from the mold a bit. Not because we dislike the grass, but just because, you know, it's healthier for your stable to be a bit balanced, you know, between colts and fillies and younger and older horses and between different surfaces. It's a healthier balance, and the better stable you can have with more balance, and then you have more chances to compete in more of the bigger races, if that makes sense.
What's it like to train a horse that denies another horse a Triple Crown?
I don't know. I know we got a lot of backlash immediately after the race. You don't really view it as just denying someone a Triple Crown, but more so than you succeeded in a very big race, you know, in your own merit, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, talking with Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Another big horse that came through your dad's barn went by the name of Gio Ponti, and I can remember being at the Arlington Million when he won the Million. I guess it was 2010. We had the national radio broadcast. Our network was really just kind of getting off the ground at that point, and I can remember hanging out afterwards with all the connections of Gio Ponti, having a couple of cocktails and celebrating. That was a really special moment. Now, you know, I remember when Gio Ponti won at Keeneland early on in his career, and that was a special moment. We didn't know how good this horse could possibly be. He turned out to be one of the greats.
Yeah, no, he was terrific. He was like first or second in 14 grade ones. It just, you know, over $6 million in prize. I think he won 3 Eclipse Awards. And, no, he was amazing. He was absolutely amazing, and he was consistent, too, in the sense that, you know, he competed at the highest level as a 2-year-old, 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, as well as a 6-year-old, too. It's just horses like that come rarely, to be honest.
Do you have a favorite Gio Ponti moment?
Without a doubt. It's probably the Arlington Million. It's when he won 4 grade ones. It's his 4th grade one victory in a row. He won the Kilrow Mile. Then he won the Manhattan, then he won the Man of War, and then he won the Arlington Million. So he didn't miss a beat. He went from a mile to a mile 3/8, basically, in those 4-race spans. And he beat a star-studded field that day in Chicago. It was impressive. And to be honest, it may not even have been his best race. His best race might have been when he went second to Zenyatta in the Breeders' Cup Classic. You know, that was a tough beat because he probably ran a huge race, and it took Zenyatta's perhaps her best performance to catch us late. And even now, I still think, you know, he's going to win. And unfortunately, when Zenyatta gets there in the last, you know, stages for us, when I mean unfortunately, it's a highlight clip I see on TV and pictures and videos everywhere. So it's a bit painful to see because everyone, you know, thinks of Zenyatta when she comes down in the Breeders' Cup Classic and she gets the job done. But it was a bit, you know, unfortunate at our expense. So, but that was probably the best race he ever ran. But no, Gio Ponti, he was great. His works, you know, every morning is, you know, special training a horse of that caliber. He had a frightening good turn of foot. And he was probably unlucky not to win at least one Dubai World Cup. He ran there twice. And we had Ramon Dominguez, you know, was his stable pilot. Him and Garrett Gomez were typically the two jockeys that rode Gio Ponti. And it was just a bit unfortunate. Twice we went to Dubai, we're not able to get the job done. He just missed both times. And we didn't have the best of racing luck, but that happens. Even if he didn't always win, his record will show you he never missed a beat, and he's always very competitive, and he's very consistent. So that was the big question, was he, you know, will he get the job done or not? But you never have to worry, will he show up or not? That's for sure. He always showed up.
Is Gio Ponti a Hall of Famer?
Well, I don't know. Do you know many horses that wouldn't, you know, first or second in 14 grade ones from 2 to 6? It's he should be in my mind, but unfortunately I don't have a say. I hope so. It would be very meaningful for us, to be honest.
Yeah, he's nominated again this year. How about your dad? Is he a Hall of Famer?
I'm biased, but of course I would say yes, but you shouldn't ask me that question because I'm very much biased.
I knew what the answer was going to be.
When you think of the Hall of Fame, maybe you should take every factor into account, not just the statistics, which I think they're strong in and of itself, but also, you know, the whole either reputation or the work ethic or the way to do business, to be honest, I think should also be taken into account.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true, and we'll see if Gio Ponti and your dad end up getting into the Hall of Fame this year. Boy, what, do you even allow yourself to think about what that moment would be like, Miguel, if he gets that phone call?
No, but if it does happen, I guarantee you there'll be a big party.
Yeah, there will be a celebration that night, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure, with lots of rosé. My dad's a big fan of rosé, to be honest. So, yeah, I'm sure about that.
Visiting with Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. It's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Again, if you miss any portion, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can check out the podcast. You know, we were talking in the first half of the show about some of the people that you had the chance to work with when you were traveling with the Darley Flying Start program. And one name that you mentioned that we didn't get a chance to elaborate on was Hugo Palmer. And you worked for Hugo after you completed Flying Start in 2015. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
It was a great experience. I was very lucky. I learned a lot. When I first went on placement on the Flying Start to working for Hugo, I believe he only had like 55 or 60 horses. And by the time I left, which was two seasons afterwards, he had three different stables and over like 150 horses on the books, if not more, to be honest. And it was great. We saw a lot. You see sometimes, you know, the impact of growing too quickly, perhaps, some of the limitations you might be facing or the stresses that takes place in a racing stable. But I was very lucky. When I was there in my first season, Hugo Palmer was a big name at the time in the sense that he was winning a lot of the big key races. You know, he won the English Guineas with Galileo Gold. He won the German Guineas twice with Hawksmoor and Unforgettable Filly. He had he also won the St. James Palace at Royal Ascot with Galileo Gold. He had very good fillies, one for American owners, for the Mr. and Mrs. Jackson, you know, Lyle Stables. They had a filly called Architecture, as well as Hawksmoor, but Architecture ran second in the Yokes to a good filly of Coolmore's called Minding. So, you know, he competed in some of the biggest races in England, Ireland, France, and as well as Germany, and he was winning some of them then, and it was an unbelievable time to be working for him. It was actually tremendous, and it's the whole working in England, Newmarket, the fact that you see the different facility between, for me, Chantilly and Newmarket are two of the best facilities in the world, if you had to describe the best places to work outside of the States, and I loved it. The winters are a bit long, because there's not much of a season in the winter, you know, the race just a little bit on the all-weather tracks, so you really get excited for the Craven meeting, which is the first big weekend in April, which takes place at Newmarket, and that's exciting. And you get your two-year-olds ready for that, and they run their two-year-olds a bit earlier than we do, and get your whole stable ready for the season. And basically you have the last 4 months to think about the whole season, so then when it finally gets there, you're excited, you're keen, you're anxious, you're ready to go. And it's all systems go from basically that point all the way to mid-October, to be honest. And racing there is just, it's amazing. There's not enough words to describe how amazing it is. So you can compete at every racetrack. Every racetrack is a different shape, a different design. It suits certain horses more than others. You have to think about that. And in terms of your training, you have over 60 or 70 different tracks to pick from, it feels like, when you're in Newmarket, between the distances you want to do and where you want to go and the surfaces, between the grass, the different tracks. And then you know, in Europe, because of the winter and the downtime, you tend to bring in your yearlings and you break them yourself. So that was a new experience as well. So it's I was very fortunate to work from then, and it was a great time.
We've touched on the fact that as you've traveled with Darley Flying Start and with your dad's operation, you've been to Australia and South Africa, England, France, Ireland, Dubai. I'm probably missing a couple of places, but is there a country, Miguel, or a racing venue that you haven't been to that you say, wow, I have to get there?
I actually always wanted to go to Japan, to be honest. It was never, didn't quite work out for me. I tried once in the Flying Start, and I would love to go, as well as South America. It's on my bucket list of things to do, and I don't know if I'll ever get to there then, to be honest. But if we have a bigger horse maybe running there one day, I would love the opportunity to go. I'm not sure if I'll ever get a chance to do it in the coming years or not, but we'll see. I'm still young.
Yeah, definitely not at least this year or in the coming months, because things are a bit different with our world right now, certainly because of the COVID-19 outbreak. As a trainer, how have you had to adjust what you're doing now with your business as we all deal with these unique challenges?
So we're fortunate in that we have a small division of horses in New York with Christophe Loyal that we just shipped up that are basically New York breds. And they were never planning to running in Florida anyway. But we're fortunate that the overwhelming bulk of our stable is at Payson. And, you know, they're still racing at Gulfstream and at Tampa. And it's very much business as usual there. And since we're at a private facility, a training facility, we can train in the same capacity. All horses can be turned out in the paddocks. And for us, it's very much business as usual. So we've been very fortunate in that regard in terms of we're still racing. We got a few runners today, for instance, as well as the races are still taking place. So in that sense, the runners, it's very much business as usual. In terms of horses you're bringing back from a break, with so much uncertainty, particularly like in New York, or even what we will experience soon in Florida, we're perhaps less aggressive in terms of our training, because we're just taking them over, just, you know, hoping when will we know when will take place the coming races, and for instance, which racing jurisdiction. So in that sense, we tend to bring in more Tyrrells at the moment. We've already brought in our first batch of Tyrrells to Payson. And the horses are racing, you train out normally, but the ones who are maybe perhaps a month or two away from a race, you just slowly bring them all along, maybe a bit slower than usual, just because what's the point of having someone ready for the big dance if there's not going to be no dance? So you have to, each horse you have to tweak a little bit and think about it. And unfortunately, you just have to do the best that you can with what you know. Yeah, but we're very fortunate if we were going to have this unfortunate sequence of events. We're very lucky that we're still based at Payson, because Payson, I can't speak highly enough of it, but for me, it's the best training facility in America. And the fact that we're not based at a racetrack, we could abide by our own set of rules, and we can still do very much everything business as usual, in the sense that the horses are still looked after and their routine's not changed, not even the smallest, you know, smallest of ways.
Payson has been the hub, if you will, of the Clamont operation for many, many years now. Bill Mott also uses Payson Park as one of his bases. Why is Payson such a great place for the horses?
Payson's great. It's very peaceful. It's a massive amount of space, very peaceful. The track is second to none, in my opinion, just because it's also reflective of the number of horses training over it. It's a bit like in the sense it's like it's a small club, you know. Compare that to the population of horses training in New York or Kentucky or Florida at the racetracks. We're fortunate that we have a very small number of horses training at Payson. So as a result, you have a great track and a terrific turf course, because Mr. Brandt's invested more into the long towards it. So it's a great turf track and lots of paddocks, and I can't speak highly enough about it.
Yeah, this is a time of year, and you talked about making some adjustments with especially the younger horses that are maybe or would normally be pointing for the Kentucky Derby in about a month. Well, that's not going to happen now. So you've had to make adjustments with their schedules. And as we look down the road over the course of the summertime, talk about some of the things that you'll be doing a little bit differently this year, with the Derby being the first Saturday in September as opposed to the first Saturday in May.
To be honest, it's very much per horse. Everything you have to view is when you tweak everything, you have a plan for every horse in the back of your mind. And as long as you just follow the plan, if your plan got severely hindered by all the sequence of events, then that makes sense. But as long as you have a plan in place, you just stick to your plans. I know it's very complicated in the sense that so much uncertainty, but as I mentioned earlier, we're lucky in the sense that we're still racing here in Florida, and we're still training everything every day, and we've not been the slightest bit, you know, impacted. I know, for instance, at Tampa, they've reduced training days. I know New York, they've reduced training days. Kentucky, I believe, a lot has taken place. California just, you know, canceled racing at the moment. So I must say, like, we're just very fortunate that it hasn't quite hit our circuit yet, at least. And even if it did, we could still carry on out and continue doing what we do. It's just it's only going to be a question of time. So just look after the horses. The horses come first, and whenever the season takes place, then you can kick on. But it's just, without sounding or trying to downgrade it, it's just a small little blimp in the road, to be honest, for us.
Yeah, and like everybody else, you just have to adjust. And there are some top horses in that barn right now, Miguel, and I know you're excited about some of those three-year-olds as we make our way over the course of the summer and toward that Kentucky Derby in September. So talk about a couple of the horses that, who knows, could turn out to be the next Tonalist.
We've got a few that excite us tremendously at the moment. For instance, this past weekend, we had two nice three-year-olds actually debut for the season. The horse Gufo is my father's 2000th winner. He's been very exciting, as well as the next day, Decorate Invader for West Point, you know, the winner, grade one winner of last year's Summer Stakes. I thought it was a bit unfortunate not to win the Breeders' Cup personally, but he came back in a big way, so he would be very much exciting. And we have many exciting stars, but in terms of our three-year-olds, those would be two of the most exciting ones we have. Mr. Dean Reeves has a nice New York bred called City Man, who's, you know, shown success on both turf and dirts and winning stakes. And I think overall last year, my father had a very strong two-year-old group. I think he had like 21 two-year-old wins. I think like 19 of them without Lasix, which is a feat that he loves to mention. But it was exciting. It was exciting. And because you have, you know, a good, strong two-year-old group last year, it means you're going to have a good, strong three-year-old group this year, hopefully. And to be honest, I think we're going to have a big season. I would have said we have probably had the biggest season in a long time would have been this year. But now with the virus, you know, racing plans kind of got halted for a lot of race options. Nevertheless, hopefully it doesn't take too long, because I think between Decorate and Invader would be one of our most exciting three-year-olds, as well as Gufo. The Elkstone Group's three-year-old filly called Logic and Reason, she won her maiden very impressively in New York. She's very exciting. And we have some older fillies as well that I think you should keep an eye on too. For instance, like Feel Glorious, she won several stakes last year. She was a great acquisition. As well as Sorrentino Lemon was an exciting new filly. So to be honest, we have plenty of new horses in the stable that are exciting, and some that are coming at the right time. And let's not forget, we have like a nine-year-old called Pure Sensation, who's like, I think he's won like eight graded stakes and nearly $2 million in prize money. And he just keeps coming every year. He's the definition of fine wine. He just keeps improving as age takes place. So, you know, he's exciting too. So just hopefully we get to run, you know, most of these horses, and we'll see. But I think we're going to have a big year.
Well, only about 5 minutes left in this visit with Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Miguel, how much longer will it be before we see Miguel Clement hang a shingle outside his own barn and start this on your own?
No time soon, to be honest, just because Dad and I, we get along very well. So I'm very happy and I'm very lucky working with my father, and I'm very content where I am, and I think we make a good team. So as of now, that's not crossed my mind. So.
What's your most prized piece of racing memorabilia that you own?
That I own? I don't tend to keep memorabilia, to be honest. My most prized possessions memorabilia-wise would probably be any of the saddle towels of any of our biggest winners. Sometimes I like to make them out to pillows. That would be my sitting room. But in that sense, I tend to keep the house a little bit outside of horses and then very much at work the rest of the time. But you can't help it. Once in a while, you get, you know, severely, you know, excited by a horse, and they tend to consume your every thought, and that happens. Don't get me wrong. When Gioponti was done, that took place. When a horse called Tonalist was done for my dad as well, that took place. And we're starting to get a little bit of a fever at the moment with that three-year-old called Decorate Invader. That's taking place. But overall, you just try to treat them all the same and just look after everything. But you can't help it. Of course, some of them are your favorites just because you trust them more in the sense that you know that when you need them most, they'll show up for you. And, you know, they have a certain type of ability or a thing about them which makes them special, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I like to end the program by asking trainers to let us know a little bit something about themselves that people might not know. So I'll ask you this question. What's it like dating a two-time Miss Connecticut?
Well, that's funny you mentioned about the two-time Miss Connecticut, because I just got a two-year-old today in the stables, believe it or not. And it's a partnership, and the partnership is a fun partnership. And they decided to name the horse after me, calling it Mr. Connecticut. So it's funny that you mention it. But it's a lemon drop kid, New York bred, and he had his first day today at Payson, and actually I like him a lot. And when they named the horse Mr. Connecticut, I thought it was a joke, but little did I know when I went on, you know, Equibase, it was in fact not a joke. The horse's name is Mr. Connecticut. So I suppose, yeah, listen, it's fine. It's what many people don't know about me is I'm a very bad loser, believe it or not. And I also have a good sense of humor, but yeah, Mr. Connecticut, I'll never get over that one, to be honest with you. But we'll see. And I have a good sense of humor. But yeah, no, it's, yeah.
I can tell you my wife
like
and
dating,
I do not.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, I suppose, like, no different than any other relationship, to be honest. We both have very much our same, you know, goals and aspirations, and we both work hard and just try to make it work.
Yeah, I can tell you, my wife and I do not have children. So Acacia, as many people know, worked with us for a very long time, and we still consider her like one of our daughters. So I'll spare you the question about what your intentions are with her, although I told her I was going to ask you that on the air. So I'll spare you that question because we're just about out of time. But listen, man, I really appreciate the visit here, Miguel. This has been so much fun to hear your story and to hear about your experiences. And we do look forward to the day when Miguel Clement can be out on his own, and we'll talk to you then about what it's like being out on your own. But for now, enjoy your time with Dad and continued success moving forward, my friend.
Listen, thank you very much, and stay safe, everyone.
All right, Miguel Clement here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. And what a fun visit that was. I told you at the top of the program that he is probably one of the more well-traveled and one of the more well-experienced trainers that we have in the sport today, assistant trainers for sure, with all that experience with Darley Flying Start, which is a fantastic program. And, yeah, what a great visit. My thanks to Miguel for taking the time, to my producer, Lee Delapina, back in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of the show, head over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast at your leisure and email me, Mike at horseracingradio.net with any comments. And you can also do that on our social media page at HRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. Next week, expecting to have Kieran McLaughlin on this very same program. That's next Wednesday. Make sure you join me for that one, too. Until then, thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.